From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, going after Boko Haram, a first-of-its-kind Ebola clinic. What's ahead for the new Saudi king? Plus, it's Super Bowl time, and we'll talk also about social media. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Chadian troops aiding the fight against Boko Haram are reported to have retaken a village in far northeastern Nigeria from the militants. No officials have confirmed the report, but the Nigerian military said on Twitter that its Air Force had conducted missions around the area the past 2 days. It also indicated Chadian troops were active in the area. Chad and Cameroon recently deployed forces to combat Boko Haram, which has seized much of Nigeria's Borno state, including a key multinational military base on the shores of Lake Chad. The United Nations Children's Fund is appealing for a record-breaking $3.1 billion to assist 62 million children who are facing conflict, as well as disease and other humanitarian crises. Lisa Schlein reports from the launch of UNICEF's Humanitarian Action for Children 2015 appeal in Geneva.
The biggest chunk of the money, nearly $1 billion, targets the deepening emergencies in Syria and affected areas nearby. An additional $500 million will be used to scale up efforts to tackle the devastating Ebola epidemic in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. The appeal will provide assistance to 98 million people in 71 countries. Two-thirds of the beneficiaries are children. UNICEF's Director of Emergency Programs, Afshan Khan, says children are more at risk today than ever before from conflict, hunger, disease, and abuse.
1 in 10 children around the world, 230 million, currently live in countries and areas that are affected by armed conflicts. And children are increasingly targets of war, violently attacked at home, at school, in the street, and used as weapons and forts to fight in armed groups. Conflicts are no longer isolated to one country, but have spilled over to create crises in neighboring countries as well.
This can be seen in the Middle East. UNICEF pinpoints the Syrian conflict as the world's worst humanitarian crisis among the many tearing apart the lives of children and their families. The agency reports 12.2 million people there are in need of humanitarian aid, including 5.6 million children in Syria and in neighboring countries. While the needs in this area are enormous, Khan says UNICEF is also dealing with many other regional crises.
And we cannot ignore the needs of children in a Central African Republic, which equally has a knock-on effect on places like Chad and other neighboring countries, Nigeria, in Cameroon. Each of those children should be given an opportunity to have a basic education, basic access to health care, clean water, and be protected.
Meanwhile, Ebola continues to take a heavy toll on children. UNICEF reports about 10,000 children in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea have lost one or both parents to the outbreak, and many are stigmatized and shunned by their communities. UNICEF Global Ebola Emergency Coordinator Peter Salama says it is important that these three countries are not forgotten as Ebola declines over the next few months.
As we hopefully successfully eliminate the virus, we have to make sure that these countries and the people in them, particularly the children, benefit in the long term, because these are some of the most neglected countries on earth.
UNICEF says it will use money from the appeal to scale up efforts to rapidly isolate and treat every case of Ebola, prevent further outbreaks, and continue to promote healthy behaviors to prevent the spread of the disease. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Doctors Without Borders has opened an Ebola treatment ward for pregnant women in Sierra Leone. It's the first of its kind. Sierra Leone already had one of the highest maternal mortality rates in the world before Ebola arrived. Health workers say the situation has gotten worse as women with Ebola face an even higher risk of hemorrhaging while giving birth. Jennifer Lazuta has more from VOA's West Africa Bureau in Dakar.
Pregnant women in Sierra Leone who are confirmed or suspected of having Ebola can now receive specialized care at a new maternity ward in the suburbs of Freetown. Studies from previous outbreaks in the Democratic Republic of Congo have shown that at least 95% of pregnant women with Ebola die. The babies almost never survive. Most are stillborn. Marcus Bachman is the head of mission for Doctors Without Borders in Sierra Leone.
I must stress that too little is known about Ebola infection in general. There is more questions than answers. This applies even more so for pregnant women. What we so far observed in previous outbreaks and also in this outbreak, unfortunately, is that the virus manages to cross the placenta. And actually, as a matter of fact, the highest viral load ever found and ever tested in samples of patients is found in the amniotic fluid, in the placenta, in the umbilical cord blood, and in the fetus.
Bachman said the immune systems of pregnant women are believed to react differently to the Ebola infection, making it harder for them to fight the virus. When they go into labor, Ebola heightens the risk of uncontrolled bleeding. The new maternity ward is equipped to deal with these issues. MSF says it offers the highest level of infection control, specially trained staff and midwives, as well as antibiotics and anti-hemorrhagic medications for the mother. The specialized unit includes 4 delivery rooms, as well as a separate area with 33 beds for pregnant women to stay who are not yet ready to give birth. It is also equipped with cameras so that medical staff can keep an eye on women in labor.
With the full PPE, the number of entries and the amount of time a team can spend in the ward is limited to maximum 60 minutes. After that, the team needs to exit. With this technology, we can much, much better increase the monitoring of these pregnant women.
Bachman added the doctors, nurses, and midwives who treat pregnant women are at an even higher risk of contamination than when treating other patients. Ebola is spread through the contact with bodily fluids, something that is difficult to avoid during the birthing process. He said it is hoped that this maternity ward will reduce the mortality rate among both expecting mothers and healthcare workers, as well as give more insight into how Ebola affects pregnant women. Jennifer Lazuda for VOA News, Dakar.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
U.S. federal investigators Thursday added an American citizen born in Somalia to its list of most wanted terrorists, saying he may have knowledge of U.S. government buildings, Washington airports, and the area's subway system. The wanted man is Liban Haji Mohammed. Officials say he may be using several aliases. Mohammed lived in Northern Virginia, a suburb of Washington, and worked as a taxi driver. FBI says while in Washington, Mohammed was a recruiter and radicalizer for the Somali-based terrorist group Al-Shabaab and provided material support and resources to Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab. The FBI says it believes Mohammed left the United States in July of 2012 and is now in East Africa working for Al-Shabaab. FBI is offering a $50,000 reward for information leading to Mohammed's arrest and conviction. European Union justice and interior ministers are discussing ways to strengthen information sharing and border control, among other measures to crack down on terrorism. Lisa Bryant is following the story.
Proposals by the EU Justice and Interior Ministers aim to bolster existing measures on surveillance, information sharing, and border control across the 28-member European Union. Earlier this week, EU Finance Ministers endorsed anti-money laundering measures and backed other proposals to cut off terrorist financing. The goal, to thwart jihadists from launching more assaults like the one that killed 17 people in Paris earlier this month. Interior Minister Hards Kozlowskis of Latvia, which holds the EU rotating presidency, spoke to reporters at the start of the two-day meeting in Riga.
We believe that it is important to provide a determined response at the EU level The necessity for effectively coordinated and coherent approach is clear.
The proposals include establishing an EU-wide system to share airline passenger information that can help them track jihadists coming to and from the Middle East. Ministers also want to better control the borders of the Schengen passport-free area and to work with internet providers to remove terrorist and extremist content. The threat of radical Islam is shared by many European countries. Shortly after the French attacks, neighboring Belgium launched police raids to crack down on its own jihadist networks. Heading into Thursday's meeting, EU counterterrorism coordinator Gilles de Kerchhoff said member states are already working closely.
Believe me, the head of a security service in a country which has 100, if not more than 1,000 foreign fighters in Syria, he feels the heat. So he knows that he needs to talk to his colleagues and share and receive. So they do.
In France, the government has announced several measures to boost security and crack down on extremism, strengthening already tough anti-terrorism legislation. Last week, it stripped a French Moroccan of his French citizenship for allegedly participating in a conspiracy with a terrorist goal. There have also been calls to introduce a French-style Patriot Act, although that idea has not gained traction. This week, the French government unveiled another tool, releasing a graphic online video of killings and wounded children to deter would-be jihadists and to counter Islamist propaganda on the web. Some of the European proposals, particularly regarding the internet and sharing passenger data, have raised free speech and privacy concerns. European heads of state will take them up during a summit next month. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The large and politically diverse American delegation that accompanied President Obama to Saudi Arabia this week underscores the importance of the United States, what it places on ties with King Salman, who ascends to the throne following the death of King Abdullah. Despite the well-planned succession, however, analysts say the new monarch faces challenges and possible threats. VOA's Scott Bobb reports.
Most longtime analysts of Saudi Arabia's sometimes opaque governance say they expect the transition from the late King Abdullah to King Salman to be orderly, and that there will be no immediate change to the late monarch's policies. Upon assuming the throne, King Salman quickly named Deputy Crown Prince Mukrin as the new Crown Prince and his successor. The new Deputy Crown Prince is Interior Minister Mohammed bin Nayef. The head of the Carnegie Institute's Middle East Center in Beirut, Lina Khatib, says this is significant.
Because bin Nayef, who had been, in a way, playing this role behind the scenes under King Abdullah, now has a more formal capacity in which he can engage in this kind of activity. And therefore, I think we can expect a degree of stability within Saudi Arabia on the domestic front, but a more assertive foreign policy for the kingdom in the years to come.
Mohammed bin Nayef, a grandson of the kingdom's founder, is the first of the next generation of Saudi royalty to be placed in the line of succession. All previous kings have been sons of the founder. Analysts say the new government inherits numerous challenges. Just south of the kingdom, on the Arabian Peninsula, militants have taken control of Yemen's capital, and the Saudi-backed government in Sana'a has resigned. The victors in this conflict are Yemen's Houthis, part of the Shiite branch of Islam, and rivals to the Sunni Muslims who dominate Saudi Arabia. Of broader concern is the war in Syria, the rebellion against President Bashar al-Assad that began 4 years ago. The dominant role in the rebellion is now held by the al-Nusra Front, affiliated with al-Qaeda, and by the Islamic State group, which has seized large swaths of territory in northern Syria and northwestern Iraq. Officials in Saudi Arabia and private individuals in the kingdom have supported and funded Sunni groups fighting to overthrow the Assad government. But that position has changed, says a researcher at Tel Aviv's Institute for National Security Studies, Yoel Guzansky.
It boomeranged. Like it happened with the people that returned from Afghanistan, boomerang, and it surfaced as a potential threat to the Saudis themselves.
The new perception has led to a change in policy. Khatib says the new deputy crown prince has taken over the terrorism portfolio and new programs aimed at re-educating militants.
These things are causing a rethink in Saudi policy and are a key reason behind Mohammed bin Nayef's attempts at steering the kingdom away from supporting jihadism, especially that Mohammed bin Nayef himself has been the key person responsible for Saudi Arabia's terrorist rehabilitation and de-radicalization program.
Conflicts in Syria, Iraq, and elsewhere in the Middle East have pitted Saudi Arabia against its great rival, Iran. Guzanski says Iran's Islamist revolutionary ideology and Shiite-led leadership are a threat to Saudi Arabia's conservative Sunni-led monarchy.
In the long term, this is the number one strategic threat for the Saudis. And this threat has many layers and many dimensions. Two central dimensions. One is the regional and the other one is the nuclear. And they both, of course, connect.
The Israeli researcher says this rivalry between Riyadh and Tehran is so deeply rooted in disputes over the shape of the Middle East that Saudi policies toward Iran will remain confrontational. Not necessarily, says Khatib of Beirut's Carnegie Center.
Mohammed bin Nayef has been pushing Saudi Arabia to improve its relations with Iran. Although this does not mean a rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia, it does mean that because of shared interests, such as the rise of the Islamic State as a common threat for both countries, Saudi Arabia and Iran are likely to improve their relations in the future.
She thinks that could result in greater regional stability. In addition to the threat Saudi Arabia faces from radicalized militants, the new king faces pressure domestically from a growing number of young people frustrated by poverty and a lack of upward mobility. And the government faces demands, both domestic and international, to open up society and allow greater political and personal freedoms, especially for women. King Abdullah initiated some reforms during his reign. Beirut analyst Khatib says these are likely to continue, but at a cautious pace.
The fact that Mohammed bin Nayef is so influential and the fact that he is more moderate means that Saudi Arabia will continue to see these gradual reforms, although we will not see radical reforms, and that's because in the kingdom, ultimately, the highest religious authority, which is the Council of Ulama, remains very influential.
It is expected that inter-clan and intergenerational rivalries within the monarchy will not subside and could lead to further changes down the road. Regional analysts are confident of one thing: the royal family's overriding desire will be to maintain stability and preserve its role as the uncontested power in the kingdom. Scott Bobb, VOA News.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
U.S. Library of Congress here in Washington, the world's largest library, serves as the research arm of the U.S. Congress and is also open to the public. But the library's first home was in the U.S. Capitol back in 1801. During the War of 1812 between Britain and the United States, Britain burned the Capitol, destroying many of the 3,000 books. Former U.S. President Thomas Jefferson offered his huge personal library as a replacement. 200 years ago, on January the 30th, 1815, Congress purchased the collection. Today, Jefferson's books are on permanent exhibition in the Library of Congress for everyone to see. And VOA's Deborah Block has more.
Thomas Jefferson's passion for books and learning is evident in this collection from his plantation home, Monticello, in Virginia.
He liked books about clever invention, massive holdings on law, and then his great love, architecture. What the Congress acquired what was then the largest collection held in private hands, 6,487 volumes.
Curator Mark Dimunation, chief of rare books and special collections at the Library of Congress, says the original library was nothing like Jefferson's collection.
It was a working library that members of Congress would need: law, trade, dictionaries, some classical history.
He says the wide-ranging interests of the president changed the content of the Library of Congress.
It completely altered the notion of what was appropriate for that collection, from needlepoint designs to architecture.
Marcelo Alves, an engineer and college professor visiting Washington from Brazil, is impressed.
It's quite surprising to see a leader, a president, that is interested in philosophy, mathematics, physics, agriculture. So he was a man of huge knowledge that we won't find today.
Jefferson is the author of the U.S. Declaration of Independence from British rule and read some of the most influential books on politics during his time. This included The Federalist, a collection of articles and essays promoting the ratification of the U.S. Constitution. Jefferson jotted notes in his copy.
It is a guidebook to understanding not only the American Constitution, but as a guide towards the creation of constitutions worldwide.
Jefferson also had an English version of Islam's holy book, the Quran, which he obtained as a law student.
Jefferson, we think, acquired it because the teaching was that the Quran was Arabic law. This would cover his understanding of international law and the part of Muslim countries.
In 1851, a fire in the U.S. Capitol destroyed many books in the library and more than half of Jefferson's collection. After that, this beautiful building was constructed across the street to house the Library of Congress. Today, Jefferson's books are marked with ribbons, green for original books and gold for replacements from sources outside the library. Books with no ribbons are duplicates that were already in the Library of Congress. Dimunation says the white boxes reflect books he is still searching for.
So out of the 4,000 or so books that I needed to replace to reconstruct Jefferson's library as it was before the 1851 fire, I am down to just less than 250 books to go.
After Thomas Jefferson donated his beloved books, he never saw them again. But in the spirit of America's third president, who wanted to share his collection, researchers may use his books in the library's reading rooms. Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
Super Bowl Sunday is just a couple of days away. It's all about that championship, or it's more than all about that championship in American-style football. There are also those big parties and fans watching the games, and then viewers also tune into the world-famous commercials that send Facebook and Twitter all abuzz. Daniela Schreier reports on the social media rewards for America's priciest advertising.
With an estimated 113 million domestic viewers, Super Bowl is the biggest day in American advertising.
Follow Budweiser on Twitter this Super Bowl season for updates.
Increasingly, it is also one of the busiest days online, with social media exploding over ads that flopped or scored big.
I don't think Budweiser can tell you that the puppy ad sells more beer the day after the Super Bowl, but what they would tell you is it makes a deep emotional connection.
A 30-second ad costs a whopping $4.5 million. That's the most expensive in history. That level of investment demands social media returns, says Adweek's James Cooper in a Skype interview.
If you can tease or release your spot onto YouTube, you can get a lot of social chatter even before the game kicks off. Some of these pre-released ads and teasers get millions of hits on YouTube and create a lot of buzz, and that is a way for them to justify the cost.
Bud Light's pre-released real-life Pac-Man spot already has millions of views. Lexus is touting its new hybrid, and Victoria's Secret is showcasing its world-famous angels. Both companies release their ads in advance of the big game. Both are hoping for social media traction. In addition to Super Bowl regulars like Doritos, Sunday's ads will feature some online upstarts. Wix, a free online website builder, is betting big, as is internet news site and social media darling BuzzFeed.
native and social is part of the BuzzFeed's DNA. They're very, very good at it. That's where they're born. But, you know, they also want to expand themselves into a sort of larger media context. And then obviously the best way to do that is to be part of the Super Bowl.
The Super Bowl is a global sporting event broadcast to more than 225 countries and streaming on devices worldwide. That means the splashy ads and the attention they garner online will ripple far beyond U.S. shores. Daniela Schreier, VOA News, New York.
Wow, people are excited, huh? And it's not even game time yet. Well, star golfer Tiger Woods helped attract a record raucous crowd to the Phoenix Open on Thursday. It's a big week, the Phoenix Open and, of course, the Super Bowl. But at the Phoenix Open alone on Thursday, 118,000 people showed up to see what Tiger was up to. He's the winner of 79 PGA Tour events and 14 majors. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead, and we hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jim Harmon, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
This is Today in History. On January 30th, 1648, the Dutch and the Spanish agreed to the Treaty of Munster, ending the 80 Years' War and establishing the independence of the Netherlands. On this day in 1649, the English King Charles I was beheaded for treason. Charles was the last king before the monarchy was abolished at the close of the English Civil War. The monarchy, of course, was later reestablished. In 1835, the first attempt on the life of a U.S. president occurred when deranged English immigrant Richard Lawrence attempted to shoot President Andrew Jackson. The president was unharmed. In 1882, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the 32nd president of the United States, was born. Roosevelt guided the nation through two crises, the Great Depression of the 1930s and the Second World War. He was the only president to be elected more than twice. In 1933, Germany's president, Paul von Hindenburg, facing twin political and economic crises, appointed Adolf Hitler as chancellor. It was the first step in Hitler's eventual takeover of the government. In 1945, the overloaded German cruise liner, the Wilhelm Gustloff, was sunk by a Soviet submarine in the Baltic Sea. More than 9,000 people died. It remains the greatest maritime disaster of all time. In 1948, a member of a Hindu radical group assassinated Mohandas Gandhi, a key figure in the independence movement on the Indian subcontinent. On this day in 1972, British paratroopers in Derry, Northern Ireland, killed 13 unarmed demonstrators in what has become known as Bloody Sunday. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Warring factions in South Sudan have agreed in principle to end the conflict that has caused the deaths of thousands of South Sudanese citizens. Now is the time to put these words into action. The United States, together with its troika partners, the United Kingdom and Norway, calls on the parties to use the upcoming Intergovernmental Authority on Development Summit on January 29th to secure peace. In the face of the deplorable humanitarian crisis in South Sudan, there can be no excuse for further delay in negotiations or for continued violence. We commend the IGAD and its special envoys for their steadfast commitment to the peace process and welcome the strong message from People's Republic of China Foreign Minister Wang Yi calling on the parties to make peace. We recognize the agreement signed January 21st in the northern Tanzanian city of Arusha, which constitutes a roadmap towards unifying and reconciling the three factions of the ruling Sudan People's Liberation Movement. But we have been deeply disappointed in the continued unwillingness of the parties to make the compromises needed to achieve a viable peace agreement. Over the past 2 months, their statements have suggested they have distanced themselves from previous commitments, and violations of the cessation of hostilities agreement have continued. We call on the parties to recommit to negotiate with a spirit of urgency and compromise, refrain from all further military action immediately, and form a transitional government of national unity. Over a year after the beginning of the conflict, nearly 2 million South Sudanese have been displaced. Over 100,000 are under the direct protection of the UN mission in South Sudan, and the country remains at risk of a food security crisis. Along with other international donors, we will continue to stand with the people of South Sudan, who are needlessly suffering as a result of this conflict.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.